Welcome to Insight Live at Noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Verge Center of the Arts is a pillar institution in Sacramento with a mission that prioritizes creativity from all backgrounds. But after two artists of color were evicted from Verge last month, it fanned a larger debate about what inclusivity and diversity actually means and if local institutions are living up to those standards. Ahead on Insight, we'll unpack those conversations. Also, baby deer, they are super cute, and we are approaching a peak time for fawn season. Some people just can't help themselves and they want to touch them, which in most cases is a big no-no. A fawn rehabber, there is such a thing. They're going to come on and explain the do's and don'ts. Finally, the city of Sacramento is putting a call out to local artists for upcoming murals at Aggie Square. We'll have more information. That's all coming up today on Insight. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento's art and creative scene has been at the center of difficult conversations this year when it comes to their role in reflecting and uplifting the diversity of the city. Pillar institutions have been in a critical spotlight over what inclusivity means and if they are living up to those standards. Verge Center of the Arts prides itself on dismantling systemic discrimination and welcoming artists from all backgrounds. It is the first thing you will read on the nonprofit's mission statement. But when two artists of color were evicted from Verge last month, it fanned a public debate about power and who has a seat at the table. Many local artists have publicly expressed that the evictions are symptomatic of broader trends outside of Verge. Earlier this year, the SMUD Museum of Science and Curiosity, MOSAC, was publicly embroiled in a dispute over keffiyehs, a traditional Arab headdress that, when in black and white fabric, can have cultural and political significance to people from Palestine. And Wide Open Walls received backlash for overlooking Asian artists in their Lunar New Year and Tet mural. CAP Radio reporter Srishti Prabha dove deep into this issue at Verge and joins us now with wide-ranging conversations. Hey, Srishti.
Hi, Vicky.
So for people who are unaware, what is Verge Center of the Arts? Can you tell us about its mission and also its history in Sacramento?
Yeah, so Verge, as it is, opened in 2014 as one of the few contemporary art spaces in the Northern California region. And it spoke of having these arts resources, which would make it accessible to a wide variety of people. Part of their mission states that they foster, support, and promote the expansion of a vibrant art scene, and that it is imperative to diversity and sustainability for a thriving community. They also speak to having governance reflective of the community they serve, setting a living wage for its staff, establishing fair value work for its artists, and rendering reasonable assistance for those in need, allowing full access to the arts.
So how big of a player is Verge in the Sacramento art scene?
It's a well-known player. They're known for their SAC Open Studios, their diverse exhibitions, their educational programming. One artist said to me that almost every artist in Sacramento inevitably touches Verge at some point in their journey. And even I was touched by Verge because I was attending their clay lab. I'm not an artist. I just like ceramics because it was the most accessible ceramic space I could find.
So how did you become aware of the controversy at Verge that happened last month?
An Instagram post about two evicted resident artists of color, Latinx ceramicist Danielle Trejo and Filipina-American textile artist Esther Marie Hall, that post about them received hundreds of comments. Some of those comments were of artists sharing their stories. The post itself was written by Faith McKinney, a Black critic and curator in Sacramento. And when the two artists were evicted from Verge, she wrote this institutional critique on how race is a factor in an artist's treatment at predominantly white-led organizations like Verge.
Yeah, this can be a difficult issue to report on because it's one word against the other. So can you just walk us through, before we dive in, your reporting and your thought process when putting this story together to get as clear a picture as possible about what happened from different points of view?
Absolutely. Strategically, I started with the evictions because that was what was, like you said, fanning the flames. I spoke to Liv Moe, the executive director of Verge, and her board, and they said the cause for the eviction had been investigated and was backed by video footage. However, when I asked Verge to provide documentation or contacts of impacted staff and people who might know more about this circumstance, they kind of declined. So then I actually reached out to Esther and Daniel. And they shared that as artists of color, they were advocating for more at Verge. They wanted to be seen, they wanted to be heard, and they wanted to understand why Verge was making the decisions that it was. Esther spoke about wanting to engage and support everyone in that space and highlighting a practice where no one knew who were the new residents at Verge because no email communication was sent out. And so she brought this community whiteboard to kind of create this communal feeling and welcome people into this space. But even that seemed to cause some tension with leadership at Verge.
Okay, so this started with like putting up the whiteboard and the tools and cleaning the communal space because we wanted it to be welcoming. We wanted it to be inclusive and it just wasn't.
And Daniel began asking for transparency on studio rents and who was being given access to these spaces to promote equity and access.
I think my biggest mistake was trying to diversify from within. When you're privileged enough to be in a space like that, that's when you think about community.
Once I saw a theme emerge from their narrative, I started to seek narratives from other artists of color to corroborate what they had maybe experienced within Verge.
Now, given that when someone, a contract or an employee in any way is terminated, there's usually employment law. You can't really, you know, get into the details from a legal standpoint. But when you talk to both of those artists, why do they believe that they were terminated and evicted from Verge?
I think from Daniel and Esther's end, it was unclear. There was no communication before the eviction. That's what they told me. There was a meeting in January where they came prepared to ask a number of questions, from how their grant funding was being used at Verge to who gets access to the subsidized resident artist studio spaces at Verge. And they do claim that this meeting got heated and didn't end very well. But for both, it was clearly a traumatic experience to be evicted. Esther was trying to make a living as an artist after being laid off the year before and had been housing unstable when she was evicted from Verge in March.
You're losing your living space and now you're losing your livelihood workspace over like what could be remediated through communication and like a simple conversation, checking in. Why are you upset? What is lacking here? What can we possibly do to make your experience a little bit easier?
Okay, so we heard from those artists. You also spoke with Verge. How did Verge respond to this?
The Verge and Liv Moe chose not to publicly comment on the eviction specifically, but did mention the January meeting as part of the issue. We can refer back to the eviction letter, which kind of paints a picture of Esther and Daniel publicly maligning Verge, not wanting to participate in the residency project, and that actually there were video and audio recordings of their conduct that was used against them. But the events of the day involving Hall and Thoreau moving out of Verge culminated to the Verge filing a temporary workplace restraining order against Faith McKinney, who I mentioned earlier, who was helping Trejo move.
I also recognize the fact that we haven't handled this as competently or effectively as we would have liked. For myself personally, I was put in a position in the days that followed the weekend of March 16th that involved having to ensure that our staff felt safe being in the building and coming to work, and that the artists feel safe being in their studios and continuing to make work. And that took priority, and it continues to take priority. We're still unpacking the circumstances and what happened over the last 2 weeks and figuring out the best way to balance the community within Verge and protecting them while also opening up a bigger dialogue.
And that was Liv Moe, the executive director of Verge, responding to what happened. You know, this goes well beyond two artists and Verge. This sparked a larger outcry from some artists of color in Sacramento. Who did you speak to?
I spoke to around 15 people for the story, current and former Verge residents, former Verge staff, artists and leaders in community, and most were people of color. Liv Mo was specifically called into question by Faith, who worked with Mo on the Coordinates Ice Pack art installation in 2022.
Artists would come to me and say they didn't feel comfortable, and it just so happens that most of them happen to be people of color.
Faith said she stopped collaborating with Liv after hearing these uneasy narratives from artists of color. What followed after the evictions was also distressing for her.
You know, well, actually, it started with two artists saying, hey, what happened with the money, or what happened with the space, or what happened with fresh water? Then it ends in them being evicted, and then it turns into an institutional critique post by me, and then which turns into me being sued by them. So I think my biggest thing is like for the community to understand this is not okay. Like we are absolutely, especially for art institution, we are absolutely here. They are here for us to engage with the art. And engagement is not always positive.
And what Faith is speaking to is because Verge did file a restraining order during that eviction of an artist because Faith was helping that artist move out, as you explained, Trishti. Did Liv Mo respond to the claims and what Faith told you?
Unfortunately, she did not comment on Faith, but the petition was first denied, and when Verge didn't attend the hearing, the order was dropped. So currently, there are no lawsuits against artists.
Okay. You have a wide range of voices in your reporting. You spoke to more than a dozen of them. How does a contemporary arts nonprofit with a stated mission on its webpage of welcoming artists from all backgrounds, especially those who have been historically left out of arts communities, how does it wind up being accused of doing the exact opposite?
Right. From the artists that I spoke with, at first, they were really thrilled about the prospect of joining Verge. And then they found themselves shouldering the responsibility of promoting culturally responsive practices within and also experiencing isolation from Verge management, who might go months without actually speaking with them. Mexican papier-mâché and visual artist Ramona Garcia came to Verge as a resident for the Ali Youssefi Project, a residency aimed at underrepresented perspectives in art.
When I joined Verge 2 years ago, I was really excited about finding community and being able to ground my practice in my city. I never really felt like I was valued or that my work was valued in that space outside of that residency. It kind of just expanded into being my experience of not feeling seen.
Okay, for those who don't walk in the art world, if there is a dispute between an employer, an institution, and an artist, what recourse does that artist, which is kind of like an employee, what do they have? Is there an HR department, for example?
So I did ask Liv about their HR policies at Verge, but she refused to comment on that. Multiple artists confirmed that there wasn't one, or it was ambiguous if you filed a complaint with Liv or other leadership if action was taken.
There are state employee rights agencies. Could they just file a complaint there?
They could, but I think the burden of trying to figure that out, doing all of that, can be very stressful. Esther, Daniel, and Faith already, with all the legal action taken against them, said that it had been time-consuming, financially draining, and emotionally traumatic. And all three of them are not high-earning individuals. Many of the artists I also spoke to are immigrants and might not know how to navigate state agencies.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio reporter Trishti Prabha about two artists of color who were evicted from Verge Center of the Arts in March, sparking a public debate about the inclusivity of Sacramento's art scene. Did you learn about the value, and I'm sure you did, the value that Verge, an art institution that has been around for a decade, what it plays in the community?
Yes, I think all artists I spoke to find that Verge fits a niche in Sacramento's art community that just did not exist before. This, you know, contemporary art space that's also accessible to all different kinds of people, diverse communities, and low-income artists of color. I mean, I think that is in and of itself very unique. And it's also a player with more funding and resources than the smaller spaces that, you know, potentially artists can rent. But it can also function as a gatekeeper to the community, elevating artists to better opportunities if it wants to.
Yeah, and I mentioned at the very top of this isn't the only local arts institution that has come under controversy this year in Sacramento alone. There's Wide Open Walls. There's also MOSAC. We've had both of those conversations on Insight. We have reporting on CAP Radio as well. How do these messages intersect? Is there a larger message to take away?
there is a larger message. It seems like we're recruiting artists of color, but unable to support them internally. Maya Wallace, a former vice chair of Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission, has been championing artists of color locally since 2016. She's a Black woman with a previous career in the arts and has been closely involved in the progress of Sacramento's arts community and the efforts they've made to enhance representation within the space.
We didn't have a thing like Verge before we had Verge. And Liv, like, you know, has been the person at the wheel. And it's hard not to honor that. We're at a sort of inflection point where the next phase of this effort is to recognize and work with and alongside those artists on how they want to be supported, and understanding that the boards of these organizations, especially the like Verge and the Crocker and organizations like that, that it's not enough to be representative.
And part of this effort, she says, is actually doing trauma-informed work and having that embedded into the institution's framework. It's different to have a fundamental understanding of what a person of color can go through, and it's another thing to actually live that experience. And those two things have not actually, that gap has not been bridged yet.
Well, and what bridges that gap is having people with those lived experiences in leadership position. So when it comes to demographics in museums, what does the data show? Because what's happening in Sacramento, these conversations, it's not just isolated to our city. These are also happening at other big museums across the country.
You're right. In the U.S., arts have really been historically segregated and relegated to individuals with higher income backgrounds or of white ethnicity. A national study conducted in 2019 revealed that 85% of art collected in U.S. museums are originated from white creators. And it's a trend that's likely shaped by the predominance of white individuals in leadership roles at art institutions, which stands at 73%. Though similar data is not available regionally, artists of color I interviewed conveyed feeling like outsiders and scrounging for arts opportunities and spaces in Sacramento.
So Verge's mission statement in response to that, to those national demographics and museums that heavily skew white and affluent, I mean, their first sentence in their mission statement is dismantling that very thing. It is dismantling the historic national framework of systemic discrimination and embracing artists of all backgrounds. So how diverse is Verge as an institution?
Well, according to Verge, 64% of their exhibitions have featured artists of color, and their staff is 46% people of color. But despite Verge's efforts to recruit diverse residents and staff, the ethnic breakdown of their leadership tracks with the national trend. Their board is 79% white, and 72% of their artists in residence are white, which doesn't reflect the city where minorities make up the majority. Liv says that The Verge is committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Just continuing to maintain panels that are diverse, and that makes a huge difference in terms of, you know, the artists that get accepted into the program.
Finally, where does it go from here at Verge?
So 13 former employees have sent a letter to the board following the evictions with requests they say would match Verge's mission statement and expressed faith in Verge as an arts institution, to which they have not currently received a response. Verge reports that no staff members have quit since the evictions, and they released a statement on April 3rd that they are planning to address the community's feedback to be more inclusive.
So it is still ongoing.
It is.
Srishti, thank you for breaking all of that down and getting all of those conversations.
Thank you for having me on, Vicky.
That is Cap Radio reporter Srishti Prabha sharing their reporting about two artists of color who were evicted from Verge Center of the Arts back in March, sparking a public debate about the inclusivity of Sacramento's art scene. Up next, baby deer. They are super cute, and we are approaching a peak time for fawn season. Some people just can't help themselves, and they want to touch them, which in most cases is a big no-no. A fawn rehabber will explain the do's and don'ts. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Let's get this out of the way from the very, very, very beginning. Baby deer, they are super cute. They are so adorable that you might be tempted to pet one. Of course, most of us know that you shouldn't, but what if you happen to find a fawn all alone? No mama, no other deer in sight. Despite what your instincts might be telling you, most of the time the answer is nothing. Just do nothing. Joining us to explain why it's usually best to just leave wild animals alone is Dave Cook with Sierra Wildlife Rescue in El Dorado County, which serves as a statewide fawn rehabbers work group, amongst other things, of course. Though he's headquartered in El Dorado County, Dave is active in a dozen counties around our area and is gearing up for yet another busy season, which is just around the corner. With that, Dave, welcome to Insight.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
I learned something new yesterday, that there are fawn rehabbers in the world. What sparked the fawn rehabbing bug? How did this all begin?
Well, you know, it was really an accident. I had signed up with Sierra Wildlife Rescue to be a volunteer. We're an all-volunteer group. And I was in our center feeding baby songbirds. Call came in about a fawn hooked on a fence, and they couldn't find the fawn person. So I told him, well, I'll go and get it off the fence. I won't know what to do with it afterwards, but let's get it off the fence, barbed wire fence. And so I went out and picked it up off the fence and fell in love. So 25 years later, I'm still rehabbing fawns.
Why have you been doing it for 25 years and counting?
Well, you know, it's really rewarding work. Like all animal rescue work, it's difficult physically, financially, emotionally. But it's so rewarding. And when you see a wild animal run back into the woods that you know would have died if you had not taken care of it and returned it to the wild, that's pretty rewarding.
Yeah, it's an incredible experience, and one that I'm happy that you're part of and you get to experience time and time again over the last 25 years. Is it now peak time for fawn season, or are we just on the cusp of it?
We're on the cusp of it, although picture it as a wave. The fawns start being born every year about April on the coast, May in the valley, and then June in the foothills. So it's coming at us. The first fawns have already been born on the coast, but they're coming our way.
What does it look like for you, someone who, you know, lives and breathes, you know, fawns, come May, and when we get more inland to fawn season, are there just a lot of them around?
Well, they're all born at the same time because, like most prey species, that's how they survive, and the predators can't eat them all at the same time. So they tend to come out in big groups, and then the phone starts ringing off the hook for fawn rehabbers because that's when people see them alone and think they need help.
When does a fawn actually need help?
Well, there's two kinds. One is an orphan and one is an injured that may need help. But the orphan question is one, and you referenced it a little bit earlier, that most of the time when people see a fawn alone, it's not an orphan and it doesn't need to be rescued. But people don't understand that moms leave them alone for hours at a time to avoid attracting predators because they're too weak to have any chance of running off. So the mom goes off and feeds and leaves the fawn alone. People find it alone, think it's been abandoned. And it's not. It's just waiting for mom to come back with a meal.
Although well-intentioned, I mean, obviously that ultimately harms the fawn.
Yeah.
Do you come across that often each season?
Yeah, every season. June's the big season for birth in the foothills. That's when the phone starts ringing off the hook. More than 80% of the calls that I get, and they usually say abandoned, 80% of the abandoned or orphan fawns are not. We monitor for a while. Mom shows up and we close the books on that one. So way over 80%, it's not an orphan. But there's 20% that are. So we have to take every call seriously.
I would also imagine that if you're a mama deer and you go back and your fawn isn't there because, you know, a well-intentioned person picks them up, you know, to basically takes them away from the location where the mama deer expected them to be. How crucial is it for that bonding time? How crucial is it for a fawn to need a mama deer in order to survive?
To survive, yeah. Well, it's absolutely crucial, first, not to disturb the scene. So that's why people should always call a rehabber first rather than just jump out and grab the fawn. But if they have already grabbed it and then call us, we can put it back. The good news is deer are not one of those kind of animals where the mom is repulsed by human scent. So if you picked one up out of ignorance, call us on the phone. We're going to tell you, go put it back. And then we'll monitor for a while, make sure mom does show up and it's not an orphan. Although there are signs that can tell us that it may be an orphan.
Mm. When are some circumstances where things just head south? You know, you try to interfere, you disturb the area, and then the fawn just doesn't fare well after.
Well, it depends. You know, it's so individual to the fawn itself. Some animals react okay with problems in their environment. Others stress out and weaken and do poorly. But again, you know, for the public, if they ever see a scene like that or think something's amiss, if they contact somebody like me, an experienced rehabber, that then evaluates the situation and we know, can we leave the animal there? Can we move it just a little ways away, like if there's construction going on? Or does it need to be scooped up and put in the rehab environment?
Mm. I would imagine your job during this time is very challenging and also really busy. The phone must be ringing off the hook.
It rings off the hook. And what happens a lot is that people tend to hit deer with their car at night. So it rings, it's 7x24, it's around. So a lot of times there's no debate about if it's an orphan, if there's a dead mom on the side of the road and the fawn is hanging out by mom's body.
When the fawn is in fact an orphan, what can you do as a fawn rehabber?
Well, there's two things. One is protect it. So we bring it into rehab, it'll be in a pen, it'll be protected from predators, and we feed it appropriate things. It's one of the reasons why people shouldn't do it themselves. They should call a rehabber. Partly it's illegal if you don't have a license from Fish and Wildlife to do rehabbing. But, of course, we have the license. But also we have the appropriate food. We use a formula that's designed to duplicate doe's milk. So it's almost as good as what mom makes. Whereas people, and sometimes they do this, they pick up the fawn, they think it's starving, they go to the refrigerator. What's in the refrigerator? Cold, low-fat cow's milk, normally. So they pour that down the fawn, probably aspirate it because they don't have the right bottle of nipple, and then it's the wrong thing, and now the fawn has diarrhea. And so then even if it isn't an orphan, we often have to step in and take one.
Yeah, and not only having an upset stomach, it's stressed out.
Yeah, and the stress is. What's interesting, though, the when fawns are first born, they're not afraid of humans. They don't become afraid of humans until they get old enough, 2-3 weeks old, follow mom around, and then they see mom run every time she sees a human, and then they figure out, oh, those two-leggeds are bad, and then they learn to be afraid of humans. But the first couple of weeks, they aren't naturally afraid of humans.
Hmm. When you get a call, because you got to make this decision on your own that, hey, I believe that this fawn has been abandoned, and you say, okay, leave it alone, just tell me where it is, do not touch it. And you go yourself, how do you determine if, in fact, that fawn is orphaned and mama's just not out for a few hours?
Yeah, there's two things. A fawn that's doing fine, a young one will just hunker down in the weeds and hope you go away. The spots and its lack of scent or its protection from predators. And so it just hunkers down, hopes whether you're a coyote or a human that you don't notice it and you leave. But if the fawn is up wandering around and crying, and by crying, I don't mean tears, I mean crying out. Deer are not normally very vocal animals, but if it's crying out, that's a bad sign. Walking around crying, and if it's okay, I'll play this. Here's what a fawn sounds like. Let's see.
And this is the fawn that's actually orphaned and is
I'm hoping
crying
to,
out for mama.
That's what I'm hoping to play here.
Yeah. just breaks your heart.
Isn't that a sad sound? And now there are, whoops, there are times where a fawn does a little bit of that. Maybe mom's running late with the meal. Maybe she was chased by a predator and she's at the far end of the county. So she's coming back to deliver a meal kind of late and the fawn's getting hungry. And so if you see a one wandering around, a little bit of crying, then we're not sure. But if the crying gets louder, more frequent, more plaintive, it's kind of intuitive. The worse it sounds, they're saying, I'm not just hungry because mom's late. I'm starving out here. And that's a bad sign. Mm. There is one final test, and then I want to tell you about something that's not a test. The final test that really tells you, no, this has got to be an orphan. It's what we call the dirty butt test. Because every time the mom feeds the fawns, she grooms it. And that includes making it, you know, defecate and cleaning around there because the fawn doesn't know how to do that. If you lift up the tail and there's fecal material around the anus, mom hadn't been there for a long time. Bad sign. Got to be an orphan. That's the ultimate. But but there you have to be up close to the fawn. Watching to see what the fawn does, wandering around crying, is a better test because you can do it from a distance because you don't want to walk right up to it the first time you notice it and do the dirty butt test because you may walk up just as mom's coming back. And the fawn may not run off, but the mom will.
Yeah.
And you've just interrupted the meal.
Mm. Yeah. What happens, because I come into, if you're camping or hiking, you can come into, you're on the river, you can come into contact with deer all the time. And I think people have the urge to touch and to pet, which you're not supposed to do. Can you explain why you're not supposed to touch a deer?
Yeah, you know, part of it is just what I said. If you're touching the fawn, again, the mom may have just been coming up to deliver a meal. So you may have derailed a meal delivery system. But to the fawn itself, why, if it's young enough, it may not be stressed too much. The older they get, the more stressed they would be by that. But the other thing is, even though a human scent may not repel the mom, if you have on cologne or perfume or any other lotion and you rub that on the fawn as you pet it, it won't necessarily repulse the mom, but now the coyote can find it easier because it's got scent. And remember, scentless and the camouflage of the spots are what keep it unnoticed by predators.
You know, you get to see a time in an animal's life that we should not be able to see. You know, it's the start of their life. As humans, we should keep a distance with that. What does that feel like? I mean, you're doing it to take care of them and to make sure that they have a successful life as they can, you know, given the elements in the wild. That must be a special experience to be a part of time and time again over the last 25 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is. You feel like it's a real honor because it's always been fun all through my life to admire and watch wildlife from a distance. But to actually be up close and to see how they act is just, it's an incredible honor, incredible delight. And then again, when you let them go free and they're alive and healthy, when you knew when they came in, otherwise they'd be dead. Because we don't pick up animals that don't need help. But an orphan, up until about 5 weeks of age, they're milk dependent. If we don't scoop them up and then give them that formula I described, they're going to starve to death. And if they're injured so badly that they won't naturally heal without medical assistance, if we don't pick up those injured ones and medicate them, give them care, those would die. So the fact that not only we get to admire them up close, but we get to save their life and then see them run free weeks or months later, yeah, it's priceless.
Yeah, you and volunteers like yourself, I mean, you have an intimate relationship with wild animals, and I think it's important because having that knowledge by actually seeing their behavior and helping them thrive, you know to stay away. Whereas when you don't have that understanding or that information or that education, you know, people can tend to do the opposite. They want to actually be near and touch and take a photo of a wild animal when they shouldn't be doing that. That happens all the time. I mean, you can see posts from, you know, the National Park Service, like, don't get near the bison, you know, don't touch the bear cubs, you know, what have you. But you need that education to know that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why this work, the wildlife rehab, if people have such a strong interest, you should still just, when you're hiking, admire the animals from afar, use binoculars for a closer look. But if you really think you have the pull, you're pulled by this and want to do it, well, contact your local wildlife rehab group. They're, most of them are all volunteer. We train you, we get you going, we give you the equipment, and then you too can have that up-close experience. And again, it's priceless. You know, you don't get paid because you're a volunteer, but you almost feel like you should pay the organization for getting to do it.
You know, given that you're a volunteer, you've been doing this work for such a long time, but we also hear that you're in a transition phase. What is that transition phase, and what does that mean for Sierra Wildlife Rescue and you, who have been affectionately called Dear Dave?
Well, I have, as I've gotten older and I'm running out of years, I'm thinking, well, I might want to do a couple of things, a little more traveling than I tend to get to do anymore. But you want to hand it off well. Train people. So all the things I've learned over the years, I don't want to just walk out the door and, you know, they're lost. So training new people to know those things and to learn them not with the expensive lessons that I had to pay, because sometimes an animal didn't do well because I did the wrong thing. I'd rather train people, and now I know the right things to do. So I'm not totally out of the mix, but I'm doing more training and mentoring and less of the doing this year. And however long it takes to feel comfortable, I'll walk away.
In the last minute or two that we have, I think it's important to leave the public and listeners with some good 411. Your wildlife rescue organization that you volunteer for is an official one. You are licensed. That's all crucial. You know, how would you help guide someone when they want to rescue an animal, they see it out in the wild, to kind of vet and make sure that they are reaching out to the correct rehab organization, one that's qualified?
Yeah, and it's really easy now because of the internet. So if you don't know, all you have to do, almost every county in California has a wildlife rehab group that's licensed, just like Sierra Wildlife. And so if you just use the internet and say wildlife rehab group in my county, a name will pop up, give you contact info, or you can go online to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they have a schedule that shows all the counties, all the wildlife groups, and all the phone numbers, and you just call them. And here in the Sacramento greater area, there's Wildlife Care Association in Sacramento, Gold Country in Placer, Wildlife Rehab and Release in Nevada County. Everyone's got one. Not all of them have full fawn programs, but if they don't, Sierra Wildlife and I are behind them, working with them. Yeah.
I figure you guys are a tight-knit group. You know, if you call one of them and they can't actually do the fawn rehab work, they can point you in the right direction, which is to you and to Sierra Wildlife Rescue.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. We're here for them.
Well, Dear Dave, thank you so much for joining us. I learned a lot.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Dave Cook is with the Sierra Wildlife Rescue, and he was just explaining the do's and don'ts during peak fawn season, which we are approaching here in Sacramento and up in the foothills, and why really the big one is you usually shouldn't touch them, even if they are alone, because likely they are not orphaned. Still ahead, the city of Sacramento is putting a call out for local artists for upcoming murals at Aggie Square in Oak Park. We'll have more information on how you can apply if you are creative. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A major project called Aggie Square is taking shape in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood, and the city is looking for some artwork. Last week, a call went out for artists to create two murals for Aggie Square. Applications are open for about a month until May 20th, and an information session will be held next week on May 1st. Donald Gensler is the Arts in Public Places Manager for the city of Sacramento, and he joins us now to talk more about what artists need to know when applying and the steps that are being taken to ensure the selection process is equitable and diverse. Good afternoon, Donald.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks so much for having me.
How does one become an Arts in Public Places Manager?
Well, I don't know. I think there's probably a number of different paths to that. But I spent about 20 to 25 years doing public art projects myself around the country, and was really excited when this opportunity came up about 8 years ago to start working with the city of Sacramento.
And so I would imagine this isn't the first project that you've had to do for public places in the city. You know, what is the city's involvement when it comes to projects like this?
Yeah, no, we've been doing a number of different projects. In fact, the program itself was established in 1977 and was initially created. Some people affectionately know the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission was affectionately known as SMAC at the time. And it established really the Art in Public Places program, which by city ordinance allows 2% of capital improvement program dollars to go to public artwork for city buildings. At the time, city and county buildings. In 2019, we kind of separated from the county. What's really exciting is that establishing an office like this, while we do still do 2% for art projects, we do a lot more. We write grants. We actively look for other opportunities for artists. And we find different ways to collaborate with departments throughout the city.
So what is the city's involvement with this project at Aggie Square? Because that's basically run by UC Davis, right?
That's exactly right. And so I think that's a really important distinction. While a lot of the work we do is funding or opportunities that we're bringing to the table, this was an opportunity where our economic development department had been working with a lot of the folks at Aggie Square, especially this Wexford Development Group, and brought us in and really wanted us to help manage their selection process and just overall brainstorm how best to develop these two mural projects within their new facility.
Mm. And for people who are unaware, Aggie Square is essentially an expansion of UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it goes beyond just medical offices. There's innovation, technology. So they're really looking at a lot of different ways. And I think one of the key things, actually, I first was in conversations around Aggie Square probably 4 years ago. One of the key things is that they always really had this sense that they wanted it to be inclusive with the surrounding community and connected within the larger Sacramento community.
Yeah, we've had those conversations on Insight because Oak Park has been revitalized a lot within the last decade, but it's also been criticized for revitalization can also mean displacement and gentrification. And there was concerns from some members in the community that Aggie Square would be a piece of that. But we have had multiple conversations about that. When it comes to the murals that you have a call out for, there's two. Where are they going to be located?
Yeah, they're in two different buildings. They're both interior projects. They're in two different buildings within the Aggie Square area. One is called they're in the LLL building and the LSTE building.
Exciting.
Yeah. Exciting names. In the East Building. So I don't know really the specifics on those specific locations, except to know that it's within this larger facility. The murals themselves are kind of behind welcome centers areas. So
nice.
It's really going to be what people see when they come into those spaces.
Creating a first impression. So what do artists need to know to apply?
Absolutely. So one thing that's really important is because the focus was on trying to think about local artists and artists in the area to be involved in this project. We have a kind of a scoring rubric that the panel will look at. And one of the things that that artists will get additional kind of points for is, do they have connections to Sacramento County or Yolo County? And we say connections, and this is a distinction that I really want to lift up, because you don't just have to have a residence in that area, because we realize, just even looking at some of our indigenous populations, that they're sometimes outside of this area, not by choice, right? But by historic situations where they were pushed out of an area, things like that. And a number of other cultures and folks have felt the same thing. So that was really important that we recognize, can you describe kind of your personal relationship personal, historic, cultural relationship to the area. Besides that, we're looking for professional artists. I mean, these are commissions, so you'll be paid. You know, you need to have your insurance. There's things you need to have to be able to do these types of projects. And we're looking for mainly visual artists because these are two pieces on a wall. The idea is that they would most likely be murals, just given the budget. I'd say they're open to other mediums, but most likely the budget has been kind of created with the idea that they would be more painted murals that would be done in these interior spaces.
You're going to have an information session next week on May 1st. And where will that be located if there are artists listening right now and they want to attend?
Yeah, we started these information sessions on Zoom during the pandemic, and we really like the concept. We used to do them in person, but by being on Zoom, they'll be on Zoom. You can register on the Submittable site. I think you guys will put up the link as well. You can register for it. It's really relatively informal 1-hour Zoom session where we'll give a brief overview of the project, and then I'll go through just the application process and be available for questions and answers. So we do encourage people to participate. It's May 1st, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Zoom. It will also be recorded. We have an information packet, so once it's recorded, it gets added to the information packet that you can check out.
You make it clear that in the description of what you're looking for, the city looking for an artist, that you want it to be reflective of the community. A key piece of that are the decision makers. So who is going to be on the decision panel to select which two artists will be selected?
This is a really important part of what we do. We as a city feel that it's necessary to be transparent, open, diverse in our selection process. We recognize that selection process is so important to allow all people these opportunities and to really kind of create the best possible projects for the area. So we're doing a couple things. One, we have probably a 14-question rubric that the panel reviews, and we try to really think about and adjust those questions over time to make sure that they are inclusive, all different folks from cultural backgrounds to professional backgrounds as well. The other thing that's really important is the panel itself. And so we are working, whenever we work with a partner like Wexford, it's really a conversation around, they want to have certain folks that are architects that have been connected with the project, but it's also really important that we add folks to the panel, artists, art administrators, folks from the area that can also weigh in. And we feel that it's just so critical that the panels have both professional and cultural diversity, and racial diversity, I kind of link within that cultural diversity, because that just makes for a stronger panel and really an overall better process.
Yeah, because this selection process is happening at a time. I mean, this year alone, there have been some difficult conversations had with these pillar art institutions in Sacramento. We just led with one at the start of our show, calling into question what inclusivity means and if institutions are stepping up and actually living up to those standards. I think about, you know, one organization, Wide Open Walls, which was called into question, where artists expressed that they weren't compensated fairly. Murals take a tremendous amount of work. What kind of compensation are you going to be offering artists when they are selected?
Yeah, so again, this project, while we're helping to manage the selection process, the project budget was created essentially by the Wexford group that is putting this forward to everybody. But of course, we had conversations with them. Just to give folks an idea, for the mural location one, it's a total budget of $11,000 to the artist, and mural location two is a total budget of $18,500. And the mural location one is 220 square feet, and mural location two is 363 square feet. So I think the compensation is good. Could always find more money for these projects because, quite frankly, artists are making things most of the time at a loss, quite frankly. The amount of time and effort that they put in just to make this work is always complicated. But after the RFQ process, just so everybody understands, there'll be about a month-long review.
And what is RFQ for people who don't know acronyms?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. Request for qualifications. We feel that is so vital, so important, because artists should not be doing proposals until until they're paid. And so what will happen is through that call to artists, through that RFQ, the panel will review and score all of the artists. Out of that, there'll be two finalists for Mural 1, two finalists for Mural 2. All four of those finalists will each be paid $500 and given about 3 weeks to a month to develop a conceptual design. And then the panel will select that design that they'd like to move forward with.
All right. Well, we only have about 20 seconds left. When could these likely get painted and we get to take them in as a community?
Yeah, so the timeline is really set because this is part of the overall project in the interior space, and these need to be painted by the end of November.
This year.
November 2024. So it is happening all really fast, and we're excited for people to apply. Make sure to look, and if you think that this is something that you could do, studio artists are also really encouraged to apply, and we look forward to seeing as many applications as possible.
Donald, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Donald Gensler is the Art in Public Places Manager for the City of Sacramento, and we've been talking about a call for artists for two murals that will be at Aggie Square in Oak Park. An information session will be held on May 1st. The deadline to apply is May 20th. We have all of that information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast, and if you want to reach out to us, you can send us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and Jen Picard, as well as managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.